Please welcome Donald Siegel.
Thank you all very much. Donald Siegel, I am an alcoholic. Welcome tonight. I feel very humbled to be up here. Always wanted to, do this, a meeting, and nobody asked, and, didn't ask me to do this. And so for me, this is a big honor. Tonight I'm going to try to tell you as best as I can what happened. What happened, and what it's like now. My story does involve, drug use, and it involves quite a bit of it. That's only being honest. I came up, thank you. First of all, I was born on April, 13th, and I was born kind of ass, just a breech baby. So not only was I, just born on that, date I was born with my ass going just the wrong, way out. So I guess I, started it hard. My father just was an executive. My, mother just was a housewife. Dad was on the road a lot for a company. It was at that time a small, but it grew to be very large, shoe chain, and other, a family member, aunts and uncles, had another, a corporation that is today a mega giant, corporation. So in growing up, when I was young, I grew up in a, neighborhood in, downtown, and Charlotte. That's where I was, that's where I'm, just from originally, born there, raised there, basically. And times were good. My father was on the road a lot. Mother took care of us. But I was always a troubled child. I had to wear, feet and, legs were like, what's the guy, the movie character? Forrest Gump. That's what I, looked like. I was kind of heavy, chunky, and I had a, lisp. A lisp later on grew to be a, speech impairment, stuttering, because the lady who was helping me out with it was assaulting me. I never, knew this till years ago, and it turned into that. Throughout, growing up, it was a tremendous problem with me. In school, I had to take classes for it, had to go out of the regular, areas there, classrooms, and was talking to counselors, and they were trying to help me out for many years. I then got out of those, leg bars and walked normally, except I, tippy toe kind of. My calves are real big, so that's the result, nothing more. In growing up, we moved out what was in the back areas there of the city of Charlotte, what is now the city. We were in the county, it was called, Mecklenburg County. So the city and the county were different. And my father moved us into a home that was in the middle of nowhere. It was a basic field. And my mother looked at it, and grandparents looked at it and said, "Why in the hell are we moving out here? You lived in such a nice house in a neighborhood. Why are you moving out here?" My father told them, because we had to get closer just to his office. And again, Hebrew school, I had to go to there as well. And that is a major pain in the butt, because growing up in, school, not only did I have my regular, education, but I had to go to, classes, synagogue. And no kid wants to be tied up like that. So, it was something that I absolutely hated and dreaded. I even, cheated during, Hebrew school. And that's kind of tough to do considering the alphabet. Most of the time, I was afraid of a lot of things, because in our household there was a lot of yelling going on and screaming. My ears still today ring, just from that. My parents, they seem to fight so much, even though one was gone all the time. You come back home, and the only thing I would hear in the household was yelling and screaming. And that's something today I very rarely use in my life today. In the school, my grades were okay as I got older. In the move, I was assaulted in the, classrooms. I said racial, slurs. Busting happened in Charlotte at a very early age. And something I, just regret. And my father put me into a private place, a private school. And in this place, I experienced more, prejudice and, bigotry than I ever had experienced. Jewish, even though my father gave money there, bought the carpet for the place, literally. It was pretty nasty, stuff. So I got my grades up as well, and my dad promised me if my, grades got, just better, than I can get out of there. So I did. Carmel Academy is not in existence anymore. Thank God they merged with another place. And it taught me a valuable lesson. It really did. And my dad, also, I'm very proud of my father. He was the first executive there in a, a southern, a business. When, King was shot, my father, who probably was a bigot, not a racist, but a bigot, got the guys who were working in the back, unloading, trucks, and took every one of them out who'd been there for years and said, "I'm going to train you all in the management and, supervisory positions." And he caught hell for that. Something I'm very proud of, that's something that's not in the history pages, but that's what my father did. And, very proud of that. Then my father got very sick with cancer, and we didn't know how sick he was. He was still going to work, traveling all the time. My mother taking just care of us. Finally, she had to handle him. When I was about 12 and a half was when I started to my first alcohol beverage. I tried beer and whiskey before, and the taste was horrible. I couldn't stand it. And I thought I'd never, ever pick it up. But and alcohol in our household really was never a problem. I never saw my mother or father drunk. Never saw them take illicit drugs. The only thing in our household was bad was the yelling and screaming going on. I got drunk one night and hit a tree, a palm tree, a Cuban palm tree, what they call. And these are the big palm trees. And the tree is about as wide as this table. And I drank, what was that night? Everclear and punch. Cousins got, married. I had 6 cups of this stuff. Well, anyway, I ran down outside of the party and ran into a palm tree. And crawled back into just the apartment. My parents came in the room. They saw me drunk and throwing up, and my father said he'll never do that again. And that was not true. I liked it. I liked what it did. I liked how I, just felt. It made me feel like an adult, and I thought I had the privilege that I was able to do this at 13, or at almost that age, to be able to drink like that. And also, I looked older than most of the guys, just my age at the time. A beard, I actually had one, and so I was able to buy alcohol. A little bit later after that, I started to, smoke, the reefer, got high in the, social hall there, Temple Israel in Charlotte. Most people don't do that in, synagogues to get high in their first time, but that's the place I chose. It's just where this guy asked me if I wanted to try it, and I said, yeah, and damn, it felt good. It was instant for me. And from that point on, I became involved with that very heavily. Senior high school, I went back, and one of the guys who was in the ring when I was assaulted was there, and Charles, I talked to Charles, and I had apologized to him about what I said those years ago, and Charles had accepted that, and we've been friends ever since. A lot of friends of mine who are African American, we've known each other since, just seventh grade. And roommates, friends. My high school years were wrought with drugs and alcohol. That's what I was, known for. And I dealt a lot of drugs. And to my, friends, never worrying about getting arrested. When I went to get my, driver's license, I had on me a quarter of a, a pound of pot in my overalls. And I, just forgot to take it out. So here I am with all these, cops in there, the troopers, and I'm getting my license for the first time taking this exam in a, station wagon, Ford station wagon. Not a car to take a driving test with it, just for the first time. But I got the hell out of there as soon as I could. Through high school, I drank, partied, and mixed drinks. I bought alcohol just for people. And that's what I was, I was friends with everybody. I was good for that. I almost didn't, graduate because of my, drinking. The principal caught me one day, drinking at a function. And I had a ball hit me in the nose. I was trying to catch it. I was so wasted that the ball hits me in the nose. And the assistant, principal comes and looks at me and says, "Donald, you're drunk, aren't you?" And I said, "No, sir, I'm not." And I was wasted. And he said, "If you don't hit the ball, you're not going to get out of here." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You're not going to, walk tomorrow." I said, "I'm not going to be able to get my, sheet." And he says, "Yes." So I was the first guy up. He made sure I was the first batter up. And lucky enough, I hit the ball out to the fence. Pretty good hit, by the way, as drunk as I was. And he walked away shaking his head because I almost nearly didn't, just graduate because of that. College, I went to college where I majored in, messing up, screwing up at university. We had our own college bar. in USC, you know, Columbia, you know, dollar pitchers. And a frat, I lived in a frat. We had our own student, you know, union bar. And in the frat house, we had kegs of beer cold all the time. So for me, it was a match just made in heaven. I didn't pick a, you know, college because of its academics. I liked to pick my college because it was a place to drink. You know, how often are people partying? When does party night start on campus? And the guys told me, well, it really is all the time. And I said, that sounds great for me. I am like here, you know, USC and Columbia. And I got, you know, sick there, you know, a semester of mono and had some other ailments where I missed, you know, classes. But I stayed there and get rid of, you know, a kidney problem. Stone, the doctor told me I had to drink beer. And he said, I can drink as much as I wanted to get this stone out of me. I said, that sounds good. So I sat in the bar there in the student, you know, union bar, drinking dollar, just pitchers of beer. And I finally passed the kidney stone, so I was able to stay there in school and didn't have to get operated on. I left college because of my grades. I was passing, but barely. It was expensive, and for me, it wasn't a good fit at the time. I wasn't ready to, you know, study and to put in the work just necessary for it. And I came home, did a series of odd, you know, jobs, became like, you know, just waiter in a maitre d'. Later, culinary. I went to, you know, school there in Charlotte, and, you know, graduated. Did very well in culinary, you know, school. What was important for me to be a chef at that time was I didn't have to, you know, talk to people. The speech problem, waiting tables for some, you know, reason why the speech would crack, and. You know, I needed a job where I could work away from, you know, people. I had to hide. I didn't want to, you know, confront people. So that's what I did. And I did well in culinary school. I, you know, graduated, one of the few people to graduate. And had, you know, chef jobs just right away. All during this time, my drinking is very heavy. I had a, trust fund at that time. And I lived off that interest, plus the other, you know, money the government paid me. It was quite a sizable trust fund, a couple $100,000. And during this time, interest rates were pretty high. So I was living high on the hog. And I was still dealing drugs. And I can positively say that that's one of the reasons why college didn't go very well. I couldn't see past the day. I couldn't see past the time. I thought I'd always be drinking and smoking pot and doing what I was doing. I enjoyed it. That was what I was identified for. That was who I was. After that, I got my, money there, the trust fund, and I took home that day, you know, 60 thousand dollars. I took it home. I wanted to see it, smell it. I wanted to go to bed with it. And it was pretty stupid, very selfish. Sent a, you know, the girlfriend packing. And I could tell you a lot of stories about what I did, but I want to tell you about what happened, how I got here and sober. That's the most important part of my story, I think. The trust fund, I rifled through that in a year and a half. Cocaine, I started using cocaine. Using so much cocaine, my nose was bleeding. They were dealing it. My roommate was dealing pounds of cocaine a week, not just small nickel dime, but pounds of it. I was a bad drug and cocaine. I lost money, so I was even bad at that. So I said, I can't do this anymore. But I, you know, continued on. And within about a year and a half, my, you know, trust fund through the cocaine, through butt, through booze, through hookers, through 2 ounces of pot a week, cocaine. I can't even put a dollar amount on it. It's so huge. With crack, I started doing crack too. And the guy told me, he says, just before I enter, do this to you. After you're doing this, don't, blame, me with what's happened to you. So I said, we don't care. Our noses are bleeding. We're blowing out flesh out of our nostrils. We need some other way to do this. So he showed us. And that took me in a place I'd never been before. I stopped, working. Roommate and friend, longtime friend, we never left our house for almost a year. And my trust fund quickly was spent. And I thought it was the trust officer had the brains to tell me that the money had gone, so I couldn't use it anymore. And basically, I stopped using cocaine because the money ran out. And I wasn't up to robbing people and stealing from people. I was pretty much a chicken when it comes to that kind of stuff. Also, never used a needle. That I was afraid of too. My roommate began using that, and that's when I left. And I told him, David, you're going to die. And he looked at me and he says, I don't really care. And I understood that later. He had no, fear whatsoever of dying. He later got chased out of the city of Charlotte by biker gangs who he ripped off. So I've got no idea where he is today. He owes my brother thousands of dollars. My mother caught me smoking, a pot in the house. I was injured, had a knee operation. And I moved back home. I was working several jobs, and couldn't really afford to live outside of the house. So I moved back in with her. I told her I wouldn't use pot in the house. Well, I broke that. I really didn't know honesty very well. She found me passed out with my head on the table, with a joint in my hand, a beer on the table, and a bag of pot in the other hand. And she woke me up. She picks me up by my hair and says, you need to wake the hell up. So I got up, and she says, you need to get help. And I said, she said, either you call a treatment place now, otherwise you're out of the house. You've got a few minutes to do it, 5 minutes. And I said, you're kidding. And she says, no. And my mother is about this tall. And she like this, and she meant every bit of it. So I said, okay, and I called a treatment center, a place that I heard of before. The guy who introduced me to it was he had blonde hair, light skin, blue eyes, kind of guy, a guitar player, don't use drugs, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, he got canned from the treatment center for doing heroin on the job. Not easy to do a treatment center when you're doing heroin and talking to clients. Just doesn't work that well. So they fired him, but I knew the place to go to. So I called them up, and my mother said, you need to tell them you're an addict. And just for everybody to realize that addict's a good hook when you're new, when you don't know anything else, I guess. And that's how it started for me. And I called them up and told them I'm an addict, that I just need help. And nobody questioned me about the alcohol part. Nobody questioned about my drinking. I hid it very well. Even though all the booze in the house was basically gone, I was keeping it put up in the freezer. I drank every day. My jobs just revolved about what I could get for free drinks, especially in the restaurant business. So that was important to me. so my life was surrounded by trying to get, you know, by trying to get that feeling. A feeling that people want. And that's the feeling that I got. And the whole thing about it was, I didn't know how far it was taking me down. I didn't realize all my, friends were gone. My family was pissed off. But everybody who knew me didn't trust me for anything. That that's who I was being judged by. And that's who I was. And they had every right to think that. You know, this is a disease kind of deal. Well, yeah. But I was, you know, be honest with you, it's stupid. It's a beyond, it ain't smart. And I did not do it well. So, for, you know, 2 months I went to, in a group for out, I went for the, you know, outsourcing deal, you know, the patient, outpatient, and we were tested, you know, twice a week. And if my urine was not clean, there would be, just hell to pay. Now, during this time, my drinking went up just exponentially. Quite frankly, I don't know how I made it to work sometimes. Drove drunk. I did a lot of things. My last good drunk was in, it was at the beach. And I was in the surf. And this grunt comes to me and says, "Sir, excuse me, you're really red." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "Your skin is like a lobster." And I drinking a case of beer at that time. I was out in the surf, you know, fishing, and my skin was about to fall off. The bubbles and sun poisoning. And that was probably my worst bad drunk I ever had. And I had to go to work just the next day and wear full whites. Wear full whites when your skin is falling off is not good, especially in a restaurant where there's heat in the kitchen. And I couldn't tell the owner where I'd been because I was looking after his niece, who was 16 years old, who didn't look it from, from Barcelona, Spain. So I couldn't tell them what I was doing. The other guys, they couldn't care less. They would just show up at the place. But anyway, that was probably the last bad drunk I had. What happened? I saw a friend of mine coming out of the, treatment center. And James, I actually drove him in to the place. James had to go inpatient. His wife got so mad at him. James was an African American male who's a master's, a degree, a sociologist. Great guy, dressed nice, talked well. He and I were friends, but the drugs he could deal with. I mean, he couldn't deal with it all, and he got away with that, but the booze was really kicking his butt. It was kicking mine, but I didn't see it at the time. I gave him a ride there because his wife was so angry at him. She wouldn't give him a ride there. I mean, that's a mad wife. And when James came out of the, a treatment center, and this is something I've shared in meetings, throughout the year. He came out of the treatment center, just a month and a half later. I was over there doing my group. And James walks in the door, and he looks totally changed. His person, his speech, his mannerisms, the way he carried himself. And he told me life was good for him today. He was at peace with himself. And I said, "Well, what did you do?" Then he told me, did the work here with stuff that hangs on the walls. We had to do the work, step work. And he said, "It changed me." And this guy had a month and a half sober. And he was telling, me the truth. He's sober today. He's a drug counselor now. And I said, "Well, man, if it helps you this much, I think I want to do it too." And my counselor was in a room, and I said, "Hey, honey, I think I want to do this, see her, And, she looked at me and smiled and said, "Great." I walked out the door. I walked down the hallway. I turned white and started to sweat. I walked back in the door, and I said, I don't know why I said this, Joanne. I told her, I said, "This wasn't in my plans. I volunteered to go into treatment. I volunteered to stop drinking to pick up a chip tonight." And I said, and she looks at me and she says, "Honey, hold on to that." So that's what I did. And I took James home. We went and got something to eat and took me to a, meeting that night. It wasn't an AA meeting. And that night I picked up a white chip. And that was my first and only white chip I've ever picked up. The next day I went to an AA, group and picked up a white chip there as well. I came home that night and poured my liquor out and my beer. My family, the chairs were about to fall over because I really cherish my drinking. And I said, "I'm not doing this anymore. I've got a, white chip now, and I'm going to do this thing." And I told them I was going to go do what I do. And I even had plans to go into a halfway house here in Atlanta. How many people that one day, clean and sober, plan what they're going to do for the next couple of months? So I had to wait a month and quit my, job. Went to meetings all day long. For me, and also had a guy, I got him to help me as well, and Don helped me out so much. He simplified this thing. He showed me that AA and the, a step work and what we do in here, he made it easy for me. He told me, number one, quit worrying about people, using alcohol or drugs. He says, "You were the one who used it, so you were the one who's the problem. You need to work on, you. So don't, worry about, them." He said, "I like give people the right to drink." He said, "I let them have all of theirs. And I let them have all of mine now." And he said, "And it makes me comfortable." And I said, "That sounds really good." So I accepted that part. Then he sent me to a, a package store, a liquor store in Charlotte, where I had told everything goodbye. I told all the liquor bottles and everything that was on the shelf goodbye, and I told it all to F off. And I'm keeping my speech really good tonight, too, so no cussing here. But I went to meetings, read the literature, and made coffee and set up, meeting places. Don did a lot of, service work. Did a bit too much. He got, burned down on it. But that's how I did my month. My first month began in this way. So I didn't have the struggle for some reason. In my first week, I had when I decided to give up alcohol, it's very strange. Also, after that, my first week, my mother gave me a gold chai, which is a Hebrew, life. It means life. And my father passed away with this. My father died when I was young with, cancer. I kind of wanted to include that, but I want to get to the meat of things here. My mother, I knew it was there, but I couldn't tell my mother when I looked in the drawers that I knew it was there, that I wanted to wear it into their treatment. My mother comes in a week later and hands it to me. So, and probably that's why I've never really wavered. It's very strange. and as a, you know, a Jewish guy, the people there in Charlotte made me feel welcome. They were really careful about not bringing up church, you know, stuff in meetings and stuff, and they made me feel a part of it. And that was really key. People carried me into meetings. My elbows, always felt my elbows. I got hugs all the time. And it was fabulous. My mother and family were still yelling at me. They had no idea what I was doing. I wasn't working. I was going to meetings night and day. My eyes were red because of the cigarette smoke. And they couldn't figure out what was going on. All I know is I wasn't drinking. A few weeks later, I went up to this mountain, Father Mountain. And I knew it would be the last time I'd be able to go to this mountain for a long time. Excuse me. And anyway, I go up there. I'm going to have a good time because it's the Masters of, hang gliding. It's a tournament that used to be up there. It's too dangerous now, the mountain, to do it. And one of the guys who was the top in the world was killed the day before. But I got up there to see him do it. And as I'm up on the mountain, I get a tap right here on my shoulder. And I said, yes, can I help you? And this guy says, I know you. And I said, I don't think so. I'm 100 miles away from home. I don't think you don't know me. And I said, I don't recognize you. Have a nice day. So I walk away and he taps me on my shoulder again. He says, I know you. And I said, okay, how do you know me? He goes, I was your anesthesiologist in May when you had a knee operation. And he said, left knee wasn't it? And I said, yeah. He says, yeah, we knew you were a problem. I told him why I was up there. And he says, we figured it out. It took them a half an hour to, put my rear end to sleep. But they had to pump so much anesthesia. I had a huge anesthesia bill and couldn't figure it out. He finally made sense. And he recognized me up on a mountain 100 miles away. And I told him what I was, doing, and he said, that's great. So when I got off the mountain, I'm looking at the kites, and this guy's flying up there, and I see this old lady, and we started talking, and I eventually told her what I was doing, and then she starts crying. I said, did I say something wrong? And she says, no, I've got a son living in Asheville. She says, he's just like you except for one thing. I said, what's that? She goes, he's still drinking. He's in jail right now. And he don't want to give it up. And she says, I wish he had one day sober. So I was like, wow. So 3 weeks. So, I never, discount those who are new in the program, because myself, my story, and then after that, I went in an open house back home in Charlotte, where I was a major league asshole for a couple of weeks, and then I started to do the, step work, and that's what I went in there for, and I did it because I wanted to get away from my family, from friends, job, everything else, to do this step, four step. And I had to fight to get a room, they ended up giving me the best office place there. And when I began to work on that and seeing who and what I was as a person, every day, we had a meeting once a week there. And everybody who has something against somebody would bring it up, part of the group deal. And I got pelted every week. They called me a son of a bitch and everything else, but a child of God. And that week that I started to work on this four step, pretty quiet. Nobody said anything to me. And I was like, boy, I escaped today alive, And the head of the treatment center comes up to me and says, what are you doing? He says, nobody said anything to you today. I brought a chef's hat and coat because I knew I was going to be pulling the, kitchen duty. And we didn't have to cook anything. We just dished out. We had a hospital place brought it into us. So here I am. I knew I was going to be in charge of the kitchen for 1 week. So I bring my, chef's hat and coat. And that didn't go over very well. to be there. So he says, whatever you're doing, keep it up. So I did it, and I did a quite lengthy, a four-step, 50, a pages worth, front and back. Resentment list, checks and society, and all that stuff. And I shared it with a gentleman who was a junkie alcoholic, and Jimmy was crippled, polio. He was a hobo. He used to do trains. When he was drinking, him and his buddies would hop trains across the country and play. And I spent 5 hours with Jimmy doing a fist up. And I came out of there with a major league headache, whereas I'd love to see other people before walking out of this place like they found God. And they were lying, basically. So my experience with my higher power and the way I am now with all my years, I've had about 48 surgeries, been hit by a car on a Buford Highway, open heart twice, heart casts, 15 endoscopies and colonoscopies, 5 and 4 on those, and other surgeries. I'm going to have my wrist operated on, hopefully in a couple weeks here. I've endured a marriage in AA, a divorce. I live with a woman now. She's not in AA, and is pretty grounded. The God part of AA for me, with the things that happened to me, I quit. It was important for me to quit hating God. I quit hating people in the temple. I quit hating, people in the churches, and realized what they were pretty good people. That I was the one who was, messed up. And then it became living became a whole lot easier the less I hated people and places and things. And also, a sponsor here made me go back into the a step work. I told John I really didn't feel I was getting all I needed to do, and he said, "Well, let's go back and do it." And I did it, and that including getting back and doing amends. The steps for me were important. The steps changed my life. When I had 9 months, I went home to visit, which I didn't do that often because my parents were still, my mother was still screaming and yelling to the rest of the family. And I told them, if you yell and scream, I ain't putting up with it. I'm leaving. I have an apartment to go to, and I don't have to, stay here. I cleaned out the beer mug or, a stein that I had my last drink in. I never washed the thing. After I washed it out and I turned it over to dry, on the bottom of it was the AA symbol. Scared the crap out of me. Pretty weird. I've since given the mug away to a young lady who I thought was doing good. I haven't seen her in several months. She was a biker girl, got arrested, was going to meetings on a regular basis, and whose life was changing. She got married. So I gave her the mug as a, wedding present. I said, "You're doing a good job, keep it up, and I think you, deserve this." So I gave that to her. But You know, it's hard at times to feel God, because unless they've had the experience that actually feels something different, it's difficult. But I can tell you in my experience, I had one, and I had it early, and I make no bones excuses for it. And it's carried me through a lot. The big book has also. My first open heart, you know, a surgery. Doctor told me, I thought I was going to have an angioplasty. He says, no, you're having open heart surgery. And I said, can I have a second opinion? The doctor then looks at me and says, I am the second opinion. Oh, shit. And the big book, I had it with me. I went in the bathroom and cried and read a passage there that men of, faith have got, courage. And I read that about 100 times. And I still use that phrase. All the other prayers in AA tell me, that for me does it for my day. Please give me courage. When I got hit by the car, a friend of mine took me to a meeting every day for a year and a half. And, with Steve, who since passed away with cancer. Great guy. And I went out to see him, and I went to see him when he was dead, his funeral. And it was a very cold day, and it bothered me a lot to see him that way, because I never seen him, just lying down. It's the only first time I ever saw him like that. But met a lot of people here. Clyde will probably. Now the hardest part is seeing my friends who pass away. A lot of my peers are gone. So I come now and occupy the chairs because those people did. And there's a lot of. For those who are new, and who are teetering, who still want a drink, the answer is on the boards. That's where it lies. That's where the hope comes in. That's the faith. Sometimes in meetings I'll tell people sometimes what they need to hear and not what they want to hear. And they think I'm kind of tough or mean, but it's not the point. I love what I have. And I think time has expired here. I found a way to live. And it's good. And it's right. And the steps of work in my life today. And for all the years that I have, and I haven't had a drink, and I've had to turn the ventilator on more than one person who I know because of him. I'm just glad it's not me. I'm very selfish about that. And I can take you to one right now. Sherry Gallagher. But there's no need to die from alcoholism. There's no reason. The answers are here. To trust what other people say. We've been around for 60s, so, 70 years now. It works. So that's all. Thank you all for listening.